And for the rest of the hour, we're going to take a look at the state of science and technology research in this country. Where is it headed, and the looming problem that is becoming evident, and that, of course, is the shortage of young scientists and engineers entering the field. And according to my next guest, our ranks of scientists, mathematicians, engineers, and technologists is rapidly shrinking as fewer young people enter scientific fields. America is facing a, quote, graying of the sciences. Here's just one example. This is a really good example. NASA head Sean O'Keefe brought up the statistic before the Senate Government Affairs Committee. This is that there are three times as many scientists over 60 as there are under 30 at NASA. So, you know, they're very high in technology. Three times as many over 60 as under 30. And think about it. Many of the scientists trained in that post-Sputnik era, well, they're all nearing retirement age, and we're just, you know, not turning out enough new scientists to replace them. Joining me to talk about the problem and some possible solutions is my guest, Dr. Shirley Ann Jackson. She's president of Rensselaer Polytech and president-elect of the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She's the former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and she joins us from the Rensselaer campus in Troy, New York. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
You've spoken out a lot about this problem, have you not?
I certainly have.
How bad is the situation?
I think it's a question of what has been characterized as a quiet crisis. One where, if one took a snapshot today, mm-hmm. what one sees is a looming change, because the scientists and engineers who earned their degrees in the 1960s and 1970s have or are entering the latter parts of their careers. And because of that, retirements are expected to increase dramatically over the next two decades. Now, if you fold into that the performance of U.S. students compared to students in other nations in mathematics and science based on various kinds of tests, including certain international standardized tests, you find that U.S. students on average score significantly lower than their peers in the other countries that with which we are compared. And finally, we know that a number of other countries are making major investments in their own science and technology infrastructure, including the human resource infrastructure.
Talking with Shirley Ann Jackson this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Is it that kids are just not interested anymore in taking up these, you know, technology topics? Could it be that, you know, nuclear, I know you were past head of the NR Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Could it be that, you know, now that we don't talk about nuclear power very much in this country, people are just, kids are not interested in that anymore? It's just lost its sexiness?
Well, it turns out that these declining statistics are much broader than just a lack of interest in nuclear science and technology, but certainly that is a particular area of concern, since we do have 103 operating nuclear reactors in this country. But there's also a need in the nuclear science and engineering arena for people because of other considerations ranging from nuclear non-proliferation concerns, et cetera.
You talk about needing a different... You made a speech before the AAAS about why do we need a different science education. And you ran down a few points, but that one is there is a growing need for scientists to communicate. We've been talking about that for years. Scientists just don't like to say anything, do they?
Well, I think it's a question of where the focus has been in the education of scientists. It's a question of how people spend their time. I mean, certainly we have people like yourself, Ira, who actually do a great service in terms of bringing science to the public, and certainly there are people like the guest who preceded me, Tony Fauci, who was certainly excellent spokespersons for science. But as a general rule, you don't see scientists in the public eye, and some of that may relate to scientists themselves, but some of it has to do with an overall appreciation for the role of science and for the role of scientists.
Do you have any answers to how we get more young people interested in these careers?
Oh, I'm always one who believes that there are any number of opportunities for that. It's science, to get into science requires a kind of preparation that's built on a multi-year process. But I do have some specific thoughts about that.
Go ahead, share them with us.
Well, let me begin by saying that I've been serving with several government, quasi-government, and private sector efforts to address this issue broadly. One is called BEST, Building Engineering and Science Talent, which is an organization formed under the aegis of the Council on Competitiveness and driven by legislation, in fact, and act and support from Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson and former Congresswoman Connie Morella. The Committee for Economic Development has taken this up.
Mm-hmm.
The Government University Industry Research Roundtable took this up. And BEST had a number of blue ribbon panels that focused in the pre-K through 12 education area, focused on higher education, and focused on workforce issues. And I served as co-chair of that blue ribbon, one of the blue ribbon panels, the one on higher education. And we basically found...
Dr. Jackson, I'm going to have to ask you to hold that thought, what you found.
I will.
Because we have to take a short break.
Thank you.
And rather than interrupt, I'll let you get the whole thought out. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. This hour, we're talking with Shirley-Ann Jackson. She's president of Rensselaer Polytech Institute and president-elect of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She's the former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and she joins us on the phone from Troy, where Rensselaer is. You were telling us about BEST, I think. Well, I last interrupted you. I asked you for a solution to getting more youngsters and children involved in science.
Yes, thank you. BEST identified 9 key principles and requirements for success in attracting particularly underrepresented students into the sciences and engineering. But the real answer to your question, I believe, falls into 4 key areas. One involves improvement of teaching and teacher education and preparation. The second involves developing the kind of pipelines all along the educational spectrum, beginning with kindergarten through 12th grade and then beyond, to attract and retain young people in the sciences, engineering, and mathematics. The third is providing appropriate bridges specifically into the college experience. And the fourth is what happens in the colleges and universities themselves, mm-hmm, at the undergraduate and graduate levels.
Bring children and children who might want to be scientists and can't afford it to go to colleges. So many colleges, even Rensselaer, I know, is over $30,000 a year to go to these colleges. How can we afford these things?
Well, you know, I think you have to answer the question. You have to step back and answer the question from a broader perspective. It is certainly true that a pregnant question is, if a student has the preparation and the motivation and the talent to do science and engineering, how do we ensure that they can afford it? But I think what most people recognize is that, in point of fact, even if you look at the private universities, most private universities' financial aid programs are based on need. And mm-hmm, so for their admitted students, there are few students who are unable to attend the college of their choice because they cannot afford it. And I think all institutions, but I represent a private institution, and all of the private institutions that I'm aware of are fully committed to meeting the need of the students they admit.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Jackson, I mentioned you working at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but you're a woman of many firsts, and I'm going to just read a paragraph from your vita. It says, Dr. Jackson is the first African-American woman to receive a doctorate from MIT in any subject. She's one of the first 2 African-American women to receive a doctorate in physics in the U.S., first African-American to become a commissioner of the U.S. Regulatory Commission, both the first woman and first African-American to serve as chairman of the Regulatory Commission, and now the first African-American woman to lead a national research university, and the first African-American woman elected to the National Academy of Engineering. How did you do all of this?
Well, I certainly had parents who strongly encourage me. I happened to go through the public school system in Washington, D.C. at a time when two things came together: the desegregation of the public schools and an intense interest in this country in developing scientific talent after the launch of Sputnik. And so I went through an accelerated program in the public schools in Washington, D.C. I had the opportunity to go to MIT. I got support from MIT, but my father, in fact, worked two jobs to be able to ensure that I could be there, and my mother also worked. My parents had an intense interest in education. They believed in it and its transformative power for people's lives. My mother taught all of her children, all of us, to read before we went to kindergarten. And my father had talent in math and in science, even though he was not college educated. And so with that kind of backing and the educational background I had, I started down a path, and in each instance it was a question of a certain window in time opening, and I was prepared to step through it.
Let's take a few phone calls, if you don't mind. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Randy in Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Randy.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, my question is this a little bit of a Chicken Little thing? I got my PhD in chemistry from UCLA in 92, and I postdoced at the Naval Research Laboratory. And when I got finished, there were no jobs out there. I mean, all this talk about retiring academics, retiring this, retiring that, I ended up going to work for small businesses, and which now I enjoy doing. But when people come to me and they want advice, I basically tell them science is not, may not be the right career for you. You know, if you can do something else, you should probably do it. And so if you have what it takes to go to the Caltechs or the MITs or the Harvards, and you have what it takes to work for the most famous person on those faculties, and you can handle those politics in that environment, you may be able to get a research job when you get finished. But if you don't do that, you ain't getting a research job, and that means that you're going to be doing something other than what you thought you were being trained to do. I now raise money and work with a small company, and you know, we do government R&D, and you know, I'm half business though. I'm only partly research.
Well, I think embodied in both your question and your comment are a couple of things that I think warrant amplification. First of all, you speak about a career in science or science and engineering as being defined as a career in research, and certainly that is the way most PhDs in science and engineering are targeted. But I like to make an analogy with PhDs in economics, or a comparison with PhDs in economics, where the economics profession views having a successful career in economics, including for PhDs in that profession, that subject, as being people who are able to work and contribute across the spectrum, ranging from academic positions and the kind of scholarship and research embodied in that, working in government, working at the World Bank, working in a utility, working for a public utility commission, and working in other aspects of government. And so I think it's a question of what does it mean to have a career in science and engineering, to have the culture reflect that there are many options for those who have education and training in those areas, and depending upon how then the person's own desires mesh with what those opportunities are, then one has a successful career or not. And so I would argue that you, the gentleman from Colorado, have had a successful career while you might not be doing precisely what you set out to do initially. I'm the president of a major research university. Today, I do not do research, but instead, what I essentially do is educate and prepare the future by educating the students we have and by supporting our faculty in their educational mission and in the research they do. I do not do research directly myself, view what I do as being critically important and entirely appropriate for someone with a PhD in physics.
One of the issues that seems relevant to me is there is talk of impending retirements, but when I look around, the number that there's more people over 66 than there is under 30 doesn't surprise me. I would argue there's probably more over 70 in many of these positions than there are, you know, under 30. And, you know, part of it is that that many of the people who came up in the 40s and 50s and 60s just don't want to retire. And they're not opening slots, and they're taking their emeritus chairs, and they're sitting there, and they're taking slots where young people are coming up. I believe there are generations, and mine, I graduated in the early 90s, that there were just no openings. We had a recession, there were no openings, and the people graduating today and last year are finding the same thing. Those slots just aren't there, and those people, once they get out of that mainstream of professional development, they cannot get back in.
Well,
and we're losing generations that way.
Well, let me just say the following, and because we could, of course, talk about this for a very long time, and there are even conferences organized around these subjects. At the time I got my doctorate, which was in the early 1970s, there was a concomitant downturn in terms of opportunities for those with PhDs in the sciences, particularly in physics. I mean, one could argue that there was essentially a recession for physicists. Nonetheless, some people chose to do other things. Some persisted. And in the end, things worked their way out. And so I think what I'm really trying to say is there are two aspects to the issue. One has to do with people filling specific jobs. And I don't talk as much as I might have done in the past about people filling specific jobs, but rather it's a question of national capacity and having people educated in a certain way and at a certain level who are able to contribute across a spectrum and in multiple ways to the strength of the United States in science, engineering, and technology. Nonetheless, the various projections expect employment in science and engineering occupations, broadly defined, to increase three times faster over the next decade than the rate for all occupations. But that's not job specific. It's looking at what the broad needs will be and what the capacity we need.
All right, Steve.
Thanks
for calling, Steve.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're talking about the shortage of science and engineers this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. In fact, when I read the literature that you've written in your speeches, you make a point of saying you'd better get, you know, besides your science education, a good liberal arts education background, because you might not just be a bench scientist.
I indeed make that point. It is important for scientists, including those involved in research, to be able to talk more broadly and to broader audiences about what they do. It's important for scientists to be able to lead and work in team environments. It is important for scientists and engineers to be involved in public policy and in the larger debates about issues, many of which have science and technology at their root.
Tief, we talk a lot about scientists speaking out, making their opinions known. Do you feel that we're entering an era now of the politicalization of science, where you see, we hear scientists taking Republican positions, Democratic positions? I mean, science should be science. I mean, we passed that milepost a long time ago when we heard Republican pollsters and Democratic pollsters. We all thought polling was a science. Are we entering a bit of that now in the sciences?
I think not. I think science and scientific results rigorously derived have no politics. The politics come from the use people make of results, the ends to which people want to put scientific discovery and technological innovation. But that, in the end, is part of being involved in the larger society in which we live. And so I think it is important for those of us engaged in educating the next generations of scientists to ensure that they are imbued with an appreciation of the ethical dimensions of what they do and the societal implications. But that's different than using science to political ends.
Mm-hmm.
But it is important for scientists, as well-educated, highly educated people, to be involved in the overall public policy process.
And to be vocal about.
And to be vocal about issues, but not twisting an inherent scientific result, if you understand my point.
Oh, I understand it, because we were watching the debate over global warming, and we're seeing all kinds of statistics and studies being thrown about here these days. And sort of being a little confused about where this is all heading, and a lot of it is politically based, as you know.
Right, but that what that then drives is the need for more, not less, rigorous research and the derivation of results that are based on sound science.
Well, Dr. Jackson, I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us this hour.
Thank you.
And good luck to you.
Well, I appreciate it, because what I hope to do is to create a national dialogue and ultimately a national will to ensure that we maintain and build the kind of capability that we need, and that it involves all of our young people, including what I call the underrepresented majority.
Good luck to you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Sherlane Jackson, president of Rensselaer Polytech and president-elect of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And she's a long list of credits. She's also the former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. With help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky, Alphonse Vinh, and Dan Onstead. You can surf over to our website at Science Friday and get all kinds of links and stuff, and also leave us email there. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.